Tax Update for Saturday, November the 25th, 2006. This is Tax Update for Saturday, November the 25th, 2006. This week, close doesn't count, accountable plan rulings from the IRS. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. Podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use will include using the podcast or documents as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, it's been a short week from the IRS and court's perspective because of the Thanksgiving holiday, and this podcast is going up a little bit late because of a couple of unexpected situations that arose with myself here over the past couple of days. But everything's back under control, and we're now down here ready to take a look at a ruling that came out a couple of weeks ago that we're going to go back and revisit at this point because, of course, as I noted, this has been a rather short week, and the IRS and the courts haven't turned out a lot of documents in this short Thanksgiving week for new and brand new developments to take a look at. What we're going to look at is actually a pair of rulings, one from a year ago, one from a couple of weeks back, where the IRS has indicated their position on how you must handle Section 62C accountable plans. More specifically, the IRS's position that they seem to believe, based upon these two rulings, that employers are attempting to deal with kind of a, well, we'll get it closed and kind of be in the ballpark and we'll be able to exclude the amounts from income. And the IRS has indicated in both of these rulings that essentially their position is a strict position on what must be done for employers to exclude these amounts from the employee's income. Now let's revisit, because we've talked about Section 62C before in the accountable plans. As you are aware from previous podcasts, generally anything that is received as income under Section 61 becomes includable in a person's income. And basically for these purposes, any amounts that an employer pays to an employee generally by default are wages. Now, Section 62C provides that basically we can exclude amounts that are paid to an employee to reimburse them for expenses that would otherwise be deductible by the employee. Now, as we know, an employee who pays employee business expenses has a few significant problems. Number one problem, if you pay the expenses and deduct them, you must itemize deductions. As we pretty much aware, for many W-2 employees, especially if they do not have home mortgage interest or have insignificant home mortgage interest or perhaps live in a state without an income tax, especially if we don't get the sales tax deduction re-added, it may be an issue where they're taking the standard deduction. In fact, statistics indicate the vast majority of taxpayers take the standard deduction. Therefore, unless they had enough employee business expenses to wipe out the standard deduction, they'd get no benefit. As well, to the extent they have to pay expenses to get up the standard deduction anyway, those expenses are effectively lost. They would have gotten the standard deduction. On top of that, employee business expenses are miscellaneous itemized deductions. As we've discussed before, Section 62 generally allows a deduction for business expenses above the line, but then goes on and specifically tells us that if you're an employee, that's not where the deduction goes. Those deductions are itemized deductions. And, as we've discussed before, the default for itemized deductions is they are miscellaneous and subject to the 2% limitation. And since employee business expenses are not excluded from that treatment, they are subject to that as well. By default, itemized deductions are not allowable for AMT purposes unless excluded. And again, these deductions are not excluded. So for alternative minimum tax purposes, an employee would get no benefit from paying employee business expenses as well. When we deal with an accountable plan situation, if we have to include the payments in income and then take a deduction below the line, which is the statement if we don't have an accountable plan, those payments above the line raise adjusted gross income. As we are very aware, Congress pegs a lot of benefits to adjusted gross income and either phases them out so that there's a loss of benefit for each dollar your AGI grows, or eliminates them completely on a cliff basis, where if your income goes above certain levels, you just automatically lose the right to get certain tax benefits. For instance, Roth IRA conversions or Roth IRA benefits for a Roth IRA, eligibility for a Roth IRA will eventually fall off the edge of the earth if your AGI rises too high. So having an amount included in AGI can cause a number of tax problems, even if we get the offsetting deduction, even if we had enough itemized deductions to itemize, and even if we had enough miscellaneous deductions before employee business expenses to be able to basically offset entirely the amount we paid above the line, we still may end up in a worse tax position. As well, payments that are not considered to be accountable plan payments are also subject to FICA and all of the standard payroll taxes. Those are payments that both the employer and the employee for FICA or the employer for the purposes of FUTA and other payments would basically not have to pick up if the amounts are not considered wages generally. So for all these reasons, we tend to look toward the accountable plan rules. Now, as the IRS notes, there are a few requirements for an accountable plan to work out. In the first ruling we're going to consider two rulings, one from last year, one from this year. The one that just came down is Revenue Ruling 2006-56. And in that ruling, as well as in the other revenue ruling we're going to consider, which is Revenue Ruling 2005, and I have the number 52, keep your notes close, 2005-52, the IRS describes the basic law. Now, as we're determined, you know, the IRS describes the Section 62A2A determines that for purposes of determining AGI, an employee can deduct expenses paid in connection with an accountable with a reimbursement arrangement from the employer. However, Section 62C imposes conditions upon the ability to exclude those wages. And basically, it does not count, an arrangement does not count if the arrangement does not require the employee to substantiate the expenses covered by the arrangement to the employer, and if the arrangement provides the employee can keep any excess funds in excess of the amount that he substantiates to the employer. If either one of those conditions are true, then the amount must be included in the employee's income and the deduction falls below the line. Now, as noted, Regulation Section 1.622C basically takes us into the rules for the requirements of Section 62C. And there are some special rules in place that go through and tell us how these particular plans work. Now, what we get into is some issues here about deemed substantiation. And we do have an issue here that in this particular ruling, we're going to deal with the deemed substantiation rules under the per diem allowances. And that's the amount of meals and incidental expenses under Revenue Procedure 2005-67. Basically, under that rule, we are allowed for meals and incidentals to treat an amount up to that amount. I can pay an employee X dollars per day based upon the amounts in the tables for per diem, and they must substantiate the time, place, and business purpose of any travel expenses, but they don't have to substantiate the amount. That ruling also goes on to tell us that in essence, if we, you know, and the amount that we're allowed to exclude is the lesser of the maximum amount per the revenue ruling that's allowed, or the amount that is actually paid. Now, we can treat the excess, if we pay in excess of the per diem allowance, the IRS allowed per diem allowance per day, and we don't require substantiation of the amount, we can structure our plan so that excess is included in the employee's income. So basically, I could pay somebody $10 extra per day as long as I pick up that $10 extra and my system picks up that $10 extra as income to the employee, then I am fine with the purposes of this particular accountable plan. I can still exclude the amount being paid. Now, basically, we have these particular rules, and the rules go down to the issues of how we handle these particular cases. Now, let's take a look at the facts of this particular ruling. This particular ruling, which is the ruling 2006-56, dealt with a trucking company. And in this case, the employer was a long-haul truck drivers, get that word out, in the transportation industry. It uses a monthly payroll period, and it pays for its services on a mileage basis. By the way, it also pays then a per diem, which it has accounted for on a similar per mile basis. Now, the compensation per mile it includes in their W-2 and treats the compensation as wages for FICA, FUTA, and withholding. Now, it's computed on a cents per mile basis, which, by the way, cents per mile is a system the IRS holds that was commonly used in the trucking industry prior to December 12, 1989. That's important because our rulings allow us to use such a system if we're there. Now, there we go. We based upon the, and the actual expectation is based upon, they computed this mileage rate based upon their actual expectation of the amount to be paid or incurred, and the average number of daily miles driven during the period. So we have our expectation that we expect these particular payments are going to be in line with the actual meals and incidental expenses paid by the truckers. And we have, and the IRS notes in this ruling that they will give you for purposes of this ruling, we're going to assume the taxpayer has computed this based upon reliable industry data and their own data from recent years, and that basically for purposes of this ruling we will accept that it was reasonably calculated not to exceed the daily meals and incidentals. Now, the taxpayer requires the drivers to provide logs to substantiate the time, place, and business purpose of travel away from home for the partial day. They do not require the truckers to give them the actual meals and incidental expenses that they paid. It basically, they're going to rely upon the administrative guidance and the per diem rules rather than requiring the truck drivers to submit actual details of amounts paid. Now, for 2006, they elected to use $52 per day as the rate, which was allowed for all localities, subject to Section 4.04 of Revenue Proc 2005-67. Thus, as a note, for 2006, $52 or less per day of meals and incidental paid or incurred by the drivers while traveling away from home may be deemed substantiated. Now, the IRS goes on to note, and this was the key part of this fact pattern, the allowances that were paid by this particular employer for many of its drivers for meals and incidental incurred on travel away from home during the monthly pay period routinely exceed $52 per day, even when computed on the monthly basis pursuant to the periodic rule provided in the revenue proc in question, 2005-67. Now, the taxpayer does require the drivers to return any amounts paid to them for meals incidental with respect to days they were not away from home on business travel. They do not require them to return the excess over the $52 per day deemed substantiated, nor do they have a method in place to actually track the cents per miles mechanism to ensure whether it is greater than or less than $52 per day. And of course, for that reason, obviously, they don't treat any amount paid in excess of $52 per day to a truck driver as wages. Now, the question becomes, under this fact pattern, what is the result? The key issue, which I think the IRS is trying to address here, is probably what I would call an examination issue. That is, can we go in on exam and say, oh, okay, we'll grant you then, you know, we've got all these truck drivers, we've now gone back and done the analysis, we know who got more than $52 per day, okay, only that amount would be treated as wages, so that we can retroactively go back and fix it. What the IRS is going to tell us in this ruling is, sorry, that's not the method, and they're going to go down the abuse rules in order to get around it in this case, which seems like a rather aggressive use of the abuse rules, but it also indicates that the IRS believes this was a safe harbor and this particular rule was granted to simplify matters, and when we do that, you better follow the rule exactly. Now, the IRS went on to say, essentially, here's the problem. The fact is that they deem everything else pretty much as covered. The only question is the substantiation rules and whether they were required to repay the excess. Truckers were not required to repay any amounts they paid in excess of the $52 per day that they received, nor did the company have any mechanism to track who got more than $52, and obviously, nor did the company include that amount in wages. Now, the problem becomes that under Section 1.62-2K of the regulations, is that the IRS says if the payment pattern indicates a pattern of abuse under the rules of Section 62C, all payments made under the arrangement are treated as a non-accountable plan. Under this ruling, they have essentially held that this particular ruling, that basically, as they note, is operating in 2006, the taxpayer's expense allowance arrangement routinely results in payments of excess allowances that are not repaid or treated as wages. Taxpayers' failure to track the excess allowances and its routine payment of excess allowances that are not repaid or treated as wages evidences a pattern of abuse under Regulation Section 1.62-2K. It go on to specifically note the fact that the amounts that were paid to particular drivers may be small and immaterial compared to the total amounts paid to each buyer, and that if we'd actually did the accounting, there would have been very little paid over is not relevant. The IRS says the taxpayer's arrangement is neither structured nor operated to meet the requirements of the accountable plan regulations for per diem allowance. As a result, taxpayer has more than a failure to account for particular driver's excess allowance or excess allowances paid to drivers for a particular period of travel. Taxpayer's arrangement evidences a pattern of abuse. Goes on to note, accordingly, even if taxpayer's expense allowance arrangement otherwise meets the business connection, substantiation, and return of excess requirements of accountable plan for allowances paid to taxpayer's drivers up to the amount that may be deemed substantiated, all payments under the taxpayer's expense allowance arrangement are treated as paid under a non-accountable plan. Taxpayer must include all amounts paid under the arrangement to reimburse drivers M&IE, not just the excess allowances, in the wages on W-2 and must treat these amounts as wages for withholding and payment of employment taxes. So the IRS has essentially said that if you don't get this thing right, if you try to do this and argue you're close, we don't take the close argument. At this point, we simply say you had to do this correctly, you failed to do it correctly, you include the amounts in income. Now, this is related, probably. There was a ruling a year ago that dealt with a slightly different issue. This was 2005-52, and this is another case of supposedly a close but no horseshoes. No, but close but not good enough. This is not horseshoes nor hand grenades. 2005-52, we had a tool allowance paid by an employer to the employees under a plan. And the question became, was a tool allowance, which used a combination of data from national surveys for the service technicians in question and basically came up with what would otherwise be a reasonable amount, was that okay to use? And the IRS came down and said, no, there is no deemed substantiation. In essence, if the only deemed substantiation rule is the per diem rule. Therefore, we're not going to allow you to do this. While you could pay this under this, it might be a reasonable basis for your advances to employees for the amounts for tools, it is not a reasonable amount for accounting for or showing the amount was paid, and that these amounts must be paid and must be handled correctly under the plan. The IRS notes in this ruling, even if the employer required the employees to substantiate the actual amounts of expenses and the employer treated a portion of the tool allowance they received that exceeded the amounts as wages, the arrangement would not be an accountable plan. The IRS points out that outside of the per diem allowance, the IRS position is only the per diem allowance allows including the excess in wages. They go with the exception of circumstances where employee expenses are covered under a mileage or per diem allowance pursuant to Section 1.62-2F2 of the regulations. An arrangement is not an accountable plan if it includes amounts paid in excess of substantiated expenses and wages rather than requiring they may be returned. So again, the IRS in that ruling said you can't combine these rules and try to say, well, I'll treat it up the amount substantiated as wages or not the amount substantiated as excludable, and then we'll put the excess into wages. The IRS says effectively, no, that is only allowed on the per diem plans, and that's only allowed, as we note in this year's ruling, if you follow those rules correctly, meaning you have to make sure you've accounted for and added those back in. Well, what's the point of these rulings? Probably the most significant issue is most likely, because we don't know yet until we actually see exams and see the IRS doing this, whether agents are actually going to be sticky and hold to this. But clearly, this is what I would call a fear, uncertainty, and doubt ruling. That means it is meant to convince employers that you really don't want to get close and play this game. I think that we probably have to advise our clients who quite often do not like the accountable plan rules. Let's be honest. It seems like a lot of paperwork, a lot of mess. They're going to have to tell the employees they have to get these documents in or they have to do the substantiation. They're going to pay a per diem allowance that may be less than what the employees really think is reasonable or reimburses them properly. And all of those issues say that many, many employers probably like to kind of skim by or neglect these rules and, you know, kind of play the game, well, we're close enough and that should be good enough. And the IRS appears to be, with this pair of rulings, suggesting that they don't want employers thinking they can get by with close on here. The IRS is giving, from a ruling basis, a hard line on 62C, saying you either follow the 62C rules or we're going to throw it into income. That means we probably need to warn our clients that, on paper at least, the IRS position is either you get this correct or the amount needs to be an employee's W-2 wages. Certainly, employers who don't even make an effort to get close to the rules, you have to say, seriously, those are just wages, treat it in there and go that way. And if your employees don't like that, there are issues, then we need to sit down and talk about how to make it work. I think, though, it's also important for us now, because we have this published guidance, to tell clients who want to be close but want to say, well, I'm not going to do that part and isn't that good enough. I think we have to tell those clients that the IRS has issued rulings in the past 2 years that officially suggest good enough isn't good enough, and that they need to be following these rules precisely. While it is very, very likely and very possible that under exam you may find the agent isn't going to go and throw that out, reality is, obviously, from the National Office's rulings, the agents have the support, if they wish, to go ahead and throw it out, and your client has to presume, if they don't follow this exactly, they may find themselves subjected to these, to the payroll tax liabilities, as well as having their employees be told that they need to amend and fix their returns. So given that set of fact patterns, you tell your client, now it's up to you to decide how you want to go forward. But I would say you need, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's certainly appears to be the safe path for the reimbursement. Now, this week, I'm getting ready to head off to Houston, Texas, and Dallas, Texas next week to do an advanced tax update. And given the way everything's working out this week and a couple of things that have come up, I may or may not be able to get a podcast up before I get to Texas or somewhere out there. So we may or may not have one next week. We'll take a look and we'll see. It also may depend on what the IRS gets out this week, since obviously last week they kind of took the week off. So we'd see if we have a good topic to deal with. If not, it will be back in 2 weeks. But nevertheless, if you're going to be in Dallas or you're going to be in Houston and you want to attend the Texas Society's presentations, those are still available and coming up, and I will be at those two. Not going to be going to Missouri. We found that the Missouri Society didn't have enough interest in the particular courses there, so those two are canceled, which from a practical standpoint, because of some of the other issues I'm dealing with at the office today, with, as you've noted, we've talked about the last couple of weeks with some changes we're making, I'm actually in a somewhat better shape going back to the office for that period of time, but we'll be working on those things and going from there. My other trip is coming up. I will be doing two separate presentations at the Business and Technology Expo in Columbus, Ohio for the Ohio Society. That's coming up. Basically, I do it on the second day of that particular conference, which is December the 13th in Columbus. And then I'm pretty much done, except for scheduled 2 days in New York City after the beginning of the year on partnerships and S corporations. So my travel schedule is beginning to calm down, and we're getting into year-end tax planning time. Now, this has been the Tax Update. As always, it's brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. You can visit there and subscribe to their services for access to email newsletters on tax developments and updates, as well as other tax information that is of use to tax practitioners. Visit them on the web again at www.lineberg-services.com. This has been the Tax Update.